This is Chef John Fulce welcoming you to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio, and inviting you to join me at the kitchen table for another hour of great adventures in food. Each week, travel with us from the back roads of Louisiana to the streets of Europe's capitals as we delve into food. We talk to chefs, food historians, authors, and producers. We ferret out the current trends, revive forgotten traditions, and of course, we even cook some of those important recipes. That's Stirring It Up next, but first the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Barbara Klein. Long-term unemployment benefits expire for more than a million Americans today. The government program that helps the unemployed after their state benefits run out expires. Rhode Island Public Radio's John Bender reports it has a major impact on the country's smallest state, which has one of the nation's highest unemployment rates.
Some 5,000 Rhode Islanders will lose their jobless benefits after Congress failed to renew the Emergency Unemployment Compensation Program before leaving for the holidays. Head of the Rhode Island Department of Labor and Training, Charles Fogarty, says the agency is working to inform affected individuals of resources they may need.
We've had discussions with folks at the United Way letting them know this was coming down the pike, and they've alerted individuals. We've sent out materials about the SNAP program. Some folks may be eligible for other programs, and also some people, quite frankly, are going to need to touch base with their friends and relatives about getting help to get through.
Benefits will run out for about 9,000 more Rhode Island residents in the coming months. The state is tied with Nevada for the highest unemployment rate in the country at 9%. For NPR News, I'm John Bender in Providence.
Most of the lawsuits against the federal government for damages that occurred during Hurricane Katrina have been dismissed. More than 500,000 New Orleans residents filed claims against the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers for levee and floodwater failures. U.S. District Judge Stanwood Duvall says the law as written makes the Corps immune from lawsuits, but also says the Army Corps is virtually unaccountable to its citizens. The government in South Sudan says it will attack rebel fighters if their leaders don't agree to a ceasefire. More than 1,000 people have been killed in 2 weeks of clashes. The government proposed the ceasefire after retaking the city of Malakal. It's in the country's richest oil state. But as NPR's Gregory Warner reports from Malakal, the political crisis is spawning a humanitarian one.
In a compound for UN peacekeepers on the outskirts of Malakal, 10 to 20,000 South Sudanese who fled the fighting are sleeping wherever they find space, under bushes, in fields, without water to drink or latrines. The UN humanitarian coordinator for South Sudan said it was far worse than he could have imagined. Children are getting malaria and diarrhea. Medics warn of an impending cholera epidemic. But people are afraid to return to their homes for fear the fighting will resume. Humanitarians hope the peace will hold long enough to bring in supplies. Gregory Warner, NPR News, Malakal.
In Egypt, a student is dead in clashes today between police and supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood on a college campus in Cairo. State-run media say the violence erupted when security forces fired tear gas to disperse pro-Brotherhood students who were trying to prevent classmates from getting into university buildings and setting some of them on fire. This is NPR. A ship in the Antarctic remains trapped in ice for the fourth day in a row with 74 people on board. From Sydney, Australia, Stuart Cohen reports icebreakers have been unable to get to the ship.
The Russian research vessel left New Zealand at the end of November on a mission to retrace the steps of Australian explorer Sir Douglas Mawson. A severe blizzard blew through the area, pushing sea ice around the ship and freezing it in place on Christmas Eve. The vessel isn't in danger of sinking, and there are weeks' worth of supplies for the 74 scientists, tourists, and crew. Australian Professor Chris Fogwill is one of the scientists on board.
It's very used to operating in remote locations, so we've got plenty of supplies and stores behind us. We've had a fantastic Christmas feed.
A French and a Chinese icebreaker have been unable to get through, but a third Australian icebreaker is still on its way, and authorities say it has the best chance of being able to free the ship. For NPR News, I'm Stuart Cohen in Sydney.
The Food and Drug Administration is preparing new regulations for vending machines. Under the Affordable Care Act, they'll have to display calorie information. Louisa Gelacco of Washington, D.C. doubts it'll affect customers' decisions.
I don't know. I think people will eat what they want to eat regardless.
But tourist Toby Levine says calorie postings could be a good reminder.
I think if people become aware, maybe it means you have, nobody's saying you shouldn't eat it. Maybe you have one bag of chips instead of two or three.
The National Automatic Merchandising Association says complying with the law will be expensive for small companies that have low profit margins. I'm Barbara Klein, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Walton Family Foundation, whose K-12 initiative works to empower families with quality school choices. WaltonK12.org.
You're listening to KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, a public service of the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. Find us on Facebook at KRVS Public Media.
Chef John Falls welcoming you to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio. From the swamps and bayous of South Louisiana, thanks for joining us in our little piece of culinary heaven where good cooking is just a way of life. Mornings begin here with a roux simmering in a cast iron pot, and our evenings end with thoughts of what we're going to cook tomorrow. All right, everybody, welcome to the kitchen table today. It's so nice to have you with us, and we're so pleased that you're joining us. And, of course, at the head of the table is our executive producer, Michelle Yark. How are you doing, Michelle?
I'm great. Thank you so much.
I'm doing pretty good. I know this is an exciting show for you because I know you really like this topic.
I'm just starting to learn about this topic, and I think it's something that everybody can appreciate.
Yeah, I think so, too. And right next to Michelle, of course, is our archivist, Shirley Sands. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I like this topic, too. It's anybody that likes to cook, I think, will enjoy this.
Across the glass wall, of course, the McLaughlins. How are y'all doing today?
I'm disappointed.
What's that?
I thought that the topic was cooking with brain. So I had a whole selection of music for that.
Just for brain. G, not a B. Now you know what we're talking about. We're talking about grains today. It's such a timely topic because if you go into most of the stores, the shelves that have grains and grain-related flowers, the shelves are extending and extending and extending. Being in the food business, I'm always looking for opportunities to create interesting and delicious dishes. As I continually tell my culinary students at Nicholls State University, one of the two main tasks of the chef is to build flavor. The other one is to manage heat. Of course, grains give us a lot of opportunity to do that.
Grains are very flavorful. And when you talk about all the shelves of these different grains, to average people like me, it can be pretty intimidating. You know, our good friend Mary Martin, who represents dairy, but she's also a nutritionist, is always talking about putting whole grains in your diet. And it's confusing. And until recently, when I would hear whole grain, I think, I don't like wheat.
Most Americans grew up in a society where there was white flour, there was corn, and there was oats. And most of your grains came from cereals. You either got a little corn flakes or you got a little bran flakes. And that's how you knew even the name of grain. Corn and wheat flour are the two things that we know the most about. And that's all we really needed until people started to get a little bit more conscious of nutrition. Thanks to the interest of the farmers all over the country who are willing to grow and experiment with special and unique crops, we're now able to create fabulous dishes and experiment with new and interesting things. Over the last couple of decades, one really valuable movement has been toward the use of many grains that were grown in America in the past and then fell out of fashion because remember the huge number of cultures coming over to this country. Grains have always been an important component in the human diet, and yet they have also been given bad names.
Sure, because I mean, you know, the idea of a carbohydrate.
In efforts to provide large yields, some grains were hybridized and lost some of their flavor. Some grains were not produced on a large enough basis throughout the country to be used on a regular basis. And for others, the milling and production costs put it totally out of reach for the regular shopper. That's all changing with the movement to eat healthy and the internationalization of the restaurant industry and the markets. We now have new and exciting choices available to the cook. Just think about all the ethnic restaurants, whether you're going to the Asian restaurants, whether you're going to the Indian restaurants, even those that are inspired by our Arabic cuisines and Moorish cuisines. I mean, all of these different grains are coming in. Sorghum was introduced to America by the African slaves, and then it was found, of course, to make excellent syrup. And, of course, you see your sorghum syrups on the shelf. It's also called Milo, and we grow a lot of it in Louisiana today. It's believed to have originated in Africa, but can be eaten like popcorn or can be cooked like most grains into a porridge. Or I used to always love that word, porridge. Never quite knew what it meant. But we didn't eat porridge in St. James Parish. It could be ground into flour and baked into goods, or even brewed, obviously, into beer. Sorghum even has, of course, its own health benefits. It's gluten-free. Oats are a grain that have been a part of many children's breakfasts and have a sweet flavor that makes them a favorite of breakfast cereals. Unique among everyday grains, oats almost never have their bran and germ removed in the processing. So if you see oats or oat flour on the label, you can relax because you're virtually guaranteed of getting the whole grain where so much of the nutrients are involved in the shells. In the U.S., most oats are steamed and flattened to produce what we call those old-fashioned oats or regular oats. More oats are flattened and steamed, naturally, the quicker they're going to cook, the softer they're going to become quickly. If you prefer a chewier, a nuttier texture, consider what you see on the outside of the label as steel cut. Are sometimes called Irish or even Scottish oats. The steel cut oats consist of the entire oat kernel, similarly in look to like a grain of rice, but it goes through a machine that slices it very thin once or twice into smaller pieces that help the water and the steam penetrate and the flavor penetrate into the grain. There's wonderful, less familiar grains, too, that we're starting to see pop up all over the shelf. I remember when I first saw smelt in a pasta at a pasta shop. I said, what in the world is a smelt? But now you have things like teff. And teff is a grass that's grown in Northeast Africa. It's a very tiny grain, about the size of a poppy seed. It's a sweet grain that can be used in place of wheat flour because its gluten does not affect celiac disease. It's higher in calcium than any other grain, and makes fabulous polenta. So I don't know if you've seen any teff in the marketplace yet, but the celiac certainly have. Teff can be used in baked goods and cooked like a cereal. A lot of very interesting Middle Eastern food is a favorite. Then I'm sure you're already familiar with the bulgur, right?
I cooked bulgur wheat for the first time this past summer, and I love it. And it's such a good substitute. I mean, even for rice, if you are trying to
or like a couscous.
Cut that.
What about a little quinoa?
I cooked some quinoa as well.
You cooked
really
quinoa.
Good.
I remember the first time I heard the word quinoa, I wanted to cook it just because I love the name. Quinoa comes to us from the Americas. It comes to us as a gift from the Incas. In the Andes, where so much other great grain and other wonderful things came from, like chocolate and maybe even corn, right? Believe it or not, quinoa is botanically a relative of Swiss chard and beets rather than, say, a true grain. Quinoa cooks in about 10 or 12 minutes and creates kind of a light and fluffy, wonderful side dish that can be flavored in a lot of ways. Like if you just took grains of corn, like raw corn into grits and just kind of steamed it rather than boil it in water, you would kind of have that same texture almost, just that nice fluffy side dish. It can also be incorporated, quinoa, into soups and salads and baked goods and processed foods like cereal flakes. It's a tiny little round grain, often light color, but you can find it in all many different colors like red and purple and even black varieties. I love the black quinoa. It makes for some wonderful side dishes. Normally when there's a trend of a new grain in the marketplace, you start to see it everywhere. You start to see it in your high-end restaurants going on to some exotic dish, or you're going to find it on a salad bar where you're going to have quinoa. sitting right there, because I think people just like to jump on the bandwagon of new and interesting things. So that always works out. So salads is certainly where you're going to find a lot of quinoa. And as you can see, we have a lot to explore, you know, today. We're talking about something very, very interesting, but yet there are those food groups that tend to confuse people.
Mm-hmm.
There's also diseases or things that are affected by what we eat. And in the process, that we're always looking and searching for ways to overcome those by searching for new ingredients mm-hmm. that's available to us out there. And of course, grains are really something I think that's a wonderful avenue to explore, but yet at the same time, very confusing. Have any of you been through the aisles of some of our great exotic food stores? One of the most often asked questions I get is, what flours are available that can make a good dark brown roux that I can eat if I have such and such?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Or if I'm on a diet, because in Louisiana cooking where roux are so important, you're always looking for particular flours that'll mm-hmm. work well and adopt well to etouffees and roux and all of these kind of things. So I know, Michelle, you've been playing around with grains.
Well, just trying different things. And I was mentioning the bulgur wheat earlier, because that was something we try to incorporate these foods into our diet. And a lot of times it's hard to know how. Mm-hmm. But with this in particular, I found recipes where you just maybe use a little less ground meat. If you're making burgers, for example, use a little less ground meat and add 3/4 cup of bulgur wheat into it. And you don't even taste a difference, except that it's good flavor. And I've done the same thing. You can do that with like turkey tacos, and you have turkey meat and you just add a little bulgur into that. And even with soup, a lot of times I'll put pasta noodles in a vegetable soup, just using the grain instead. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. it's just a nice different flavor. And I always feel good about it, because it feels healthier and it is packed with nutrition.
I think the fact that most people don't really stop long enough to investigate cooking techniques that improve or deliver to the plate a real flavorful. I remember I really hated oatmeal. I really did. I hated oatmeal. I don't care what you did with it. And then all of a sudden the instant oatmeal came out that had cinnamon spices and apple spices, and you could put honey on it.
Right.
And all of a sudden the method was not about the oatmeal or the healthiness of the oatmeal. It was about disguising the flavor.
Right.
Which is crazy, because mm-hmm. people who understand the value of eating these grains or eating these oats or how to cook them or how to retain the flavor as well as the nutrition in them, that's what it's all about. We're comfortable with cooking rice. We're comfortable with making dirty rice. We're comfortable with making rice dressing. We'll make jambalayas all day long. We'll put gumbo in our hen and andouille gumbo, and it's a grain. But we love it because it's common, it's what we know, and all of a sudden we understand. We don't even think about it anymore. We've come up with 20 different ways to use it. Same thing with corn. We go to hush puppies and cornbread and grits and cornmeal. We fry fish in it. It's understandable, but yet we're stuck in that rut of those two or three grains that we come to know really well, and the rest of it we consider animal feed, right?
Well, it takes the research. You have to research the recipes and just experiment with it.
I found some really great cooking lists, you know, if you want to use this grain, use this much liquid, you know, some of those comparatives that'll make it easier if you go to the store and you see something, try some, you know, whatever it happens to be, you have on one little chart what comparisons to make.
We have a great show today. We're talking grain. We have a great guy who knows more about grain and the evolution of grain and all of the wonderful things happening in the world of grain, who's going to be with us, and you don't want to miss it. It's going to be very interesting, I promise.
Oats and beans and barley grow, oats and beans and barley grow. You or I or anyone know how oats and beans and barley grow. First the farmer plants the seeds, stands up tall and takes his ease, stamps his feet and claps his hands and turns around to view his land. Oats and beans and barley grow, oats and beans and barley grow. Do you or I or anyone know how oats and beans and barley grow? Then the farmer watches the ground, watches the sunshine all around, stamps his feet and claps his hands and turns around to view his land. Oats and beans and barley grow, oats and beans and barley grow. You or I or anyone know how oats and beans and barley grow.
Oats Glide through your weekday mornings at 11 a.m. here on the Medicine Ball Caravan. I'm Cecil Doyle. Mondays through Thursdays, we cruise through a fast-paced hour of sounds both old and new, as well as keeping you up to date with area music and arts. The Medicine Ball Caravan, 11 to noon weekdays here on KRVS.
Hi, this is Nick Forster. Every week in E-Town, we bring together musicians from a wide range of styles for some great live performances and conversation. And we also present the Achievement Award to someone doing outstanding work in their communities. It's an hour of uplifting stories and music each week on E-Town.
Tuesday at noon on KRVS.
Get ready for 2014 with a fresh musical start and a chance to discover artists whose careers are destined to gather momentum in the year ahead, along with new seasonal sounds from your favourites, this week on The Thistle and Shamrock.
Coming up Sunday evening at 6, here on KRVS.
As we sat on the front porch of that old gray house where I was born and raised, staring at the dusty fields where my daddy worked hard every day, I think it kind of hurt him when I said, "Daddy, there's a lot that I don't know. But don't you ever dream about a life where corn don't grow. He just sat there sighing, staring at his favorite coffee cup. I saw a storm of mixed emotion in his eyes when he looked up. He said, "Son, I know at your age, it seems like this old world is turning slow. And you think you'll find the answer to it all where corn don't grow. Hard times are real, there's dusty fields, no matter where you go."
I tell you, I just absolutely love the words to that song. It is life in a corn kernel. Hey, y'all, welcome back to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio. We're so happy that you've chosen to spend the day with us. There's a lot of great things to do out in this big world, but I can't think of anything better in this hour than just joining us at the kitchen table. We're talking grain today. You know, you live in a society like in South Louisiana where everything has rice on it, in it, stuffings, dressings, in our gumbos. Corn goes into frying in our grits and our toppings and our stuffings again. And we're so comfortable with it. And nobody questions anything you want to do with it. But yet, when we start to think about things other than grain and cereals, it becomes a what? Why would I eat that? A what? You know, just a lack of understanding. Today, we have a wonderful guest with us, a very good friend of mine, who I always enjoy seeing. We don't see each other enough. Why don't you introduce him? We're going to talk grain today.
Absolutely. We're talking grain with Glenn Roberts, the proprietor of Anson Mills in Charleston, South Carolina. Glenn grows, harvests, processes, and distributes some of the most unusual grains to the restaurant business.
And he's one of the best speakers on the subject.
He's also passionate about the preservation of near extinct varieties of grains and the development of new ones. You know, for years we've talked about heirloom vegetables. Well, now it's time to talk about heirloom grains. He is a great friend of ours, and it is wonderful to welcome Glenn to the show. Welcome, Glenn. How are you today?
I'm doing great, and I'm honored to be here with you and Chef John Foles. I got to tell you, that's pretty heady company.
I don't know if you heard that song about where corn don't grow. But I was thinking about you as that song was playing. I said, if Glenn's listening to this song, he's tapping his foot on the floor as I am and saying, "Boy, ain't that what life's all about?"
That's the truth. I can tell you, John, I found all those places where corn doesn't grow in my field.
Well, Glenn, it has been a while. I think the last time we saw each other person to person was probably in Napa Valley when you and I spoke together at the Culinary Institute over there. Of course, we've had an opportunity to visit often over the years. How have you been since we saw you last?
Well, I've been missing that phenomenal set of aromas that came in sequence from your presentation. I don't think I've ever witnessed that before, John, where a chef's speaking, and as he's speaking, the aromas are matching the points he's making that are going out to the audience, and the audience is, like, leaning farther and farther forward. By the time you got done, everybody was almost falling out of their chairs. That was quite an experience, I got to tell you. That was good.
Well, you know, I love sharing the stage with you, too, because you're such a great historian, and your passion for your work is just absolutely incredible, and you inspire me in a lot of ways. I read your stuff constantly. And just for the audience to know a little bit about you and about your company, why don't you just kind of give us a little synopsis?
We, and that would be me and a group of chef friends back in the day, it's like 20 years ago now, were building hotels around the South. And before that, it had been national. I kept sneaking into the food concept side of it because it was so intriguing to me for some reason. We only did historic architecture. So if you find an old building somewhere that could be converted into a hotel or inn, that's pretty much what we were doing in the old days. And I kind of fell into this backwards because I was asked occasionally, well, what's your opinion about the food that was going on to match, say, this federal we're working on turning into an inn? Without being a scholar or a historian and not being careful like Chef John would be, I'd make up stuff that sounded right from the local people I'd talked to. So I was doing anecdotal histories, and a lot of them were not correct. In one particular place, I think I ended up promising red rice to somebody without actually researching it. And I put ketchup in as one of the ingredients when I sent them the recipe, and they sent a blistering letter back to me and said, "Who do you think you are?" And that was the time at which I decided I, too, should start reading instead of talking. So that was about 15 years ago. My mom was a black skillet cook. She was raised in Aiken, South Carolina, and Edisto Island, which is south of Charleston in South Carolina. It's one of the sea islands there. And they had kitchen rice, so they grew up with those small rice plots there in the Depression. They had their own corn, and essentially they were feeding more people out the back door than they were the front door, as they used to say during the Depression. And so I grew up with all those stories. I grew up with all the familiar ideas of black skillet cookery from the South Carolina region, but it was in California. So my friends would scream when the collard on the stove and they'd run out. We'd have to go grab them and bring them back and say, "Hey, this is good for you. You're going to like it." So as we move forward with that, my mother, who was a phenomenal cook, discovered that I was a crappy cook. So I was only allowed to cook rice for the dog. But we're the kind of family that had rice at every meal. And in the South Carolina ethos, that's called diki. And I was only allowed to cook for the pets. But even the pets, the cats and the dogs, they all had rice. So I kind of had that in my bone. And I ended up working around South Carolina, Georgia, Virginia, North Carolina with these historic hotel projects. And more, I got more interested. I think one event, we got some rice from a dear friend of mine who's on the board of my foundation now, Dr. Richard Schultz. And it was way after the season. He said, "It's over at the church. I just give it to the mission. We're not selling it. Go to the church, get some rice, and bring it back." So I sent somebody to the church. It was way out in the middle of nowhere in the Ace Basin, which is south of Charleston. Got the rice, brought it back to the kitchen, and Chef and I were looking at it, and then we saw something moving. And a little black thing running over here, a little black thing. And Chef just walked out. He said, "I ain't cooking that." And I said, "I can pick these bugs out of it, Chef." So I got with the dishwashers. I'm there in Gucci's and a really expensive suit, sweating to death on the dish line, picking bugs out of rice, going, "You know what? I can't do it this way anymore." And that's when I decided to form Anson Mills.
Wow. Wow.
That's
and my simple idea from the beginning was to make corn, grow it, because I said, "Oh, anybody can grow corn." And sell grit and cornmeal and pay for rice, which is totally naive and stupid, because you can't just do those two things. You got to commit huge. So here, right, 15 years later, we're barely making it, but it's fun. It's really fun. So it makes up for everything.
Well, you've developed an unbelievable reputation, and you've certainly achieved a great place in the marketplace for quality and assurance of accuracy and authenticity in brand, and that's commendable and very hard to do in these times that we live in. So I commend you, and congratulations on your great work. It was wonderful that you agreed to be a part of our show today, so I thank you so much for that. Michelle, I know you had a question.
So many of us are just kind of becoming aware of grains like oats and spelt and buckwheat and barley. But you've been involved with these grains for years. So how did you make that transition? How did you become passionate in these kind of unusual grains to most of us?
I actually snuck in, Michelle, through the front door, which would be coming from the highly organized and terrific food ways of Acadia, the Acadie swimming the river that John talks about so eloquently, and the fact that the imprint of the history of cuisine is so clear in a lot of ways in New Orleans, but then it has, just like the city itself, all these little turns down unexpected pathways. And when I was growing corn, the first year it all blew down. So the second year I'm getting ready to go back into the same field, and the farmer says, you can't put corn back in the second field. And I said, 2 years in a row I can't grow corn again? I mean, I didn't even harvest anything. He said, no, you can't do that. My granddaddy, great-granddaddy, none of us ever did that. I said, well, what do you put here this year? And he said, well, you know, you're supposed to follow corn with peas, turn them down, grow winter peas or something like that, come back with buckwheat in the spring and harvest the buckwheat, and then you can go to a summer crop like cowpeas or something. You can't just grow corn. And that was the epiphany that started the process. When I actually looked, the first thing that came up was cloy in the crops in New Orleans. I looked at that hard. I went, well, I wonder how the foods in New Orleans tie, if you're having to grow this stuff, whether the table reflects what was happening on the farm directly with these larger crops, because heirloom vegetables are easy to contain and you can do it a little bit in your backyard, but the larger crops, if you're growing milk corn and all the things to support the land and make it really tasty, you have to actually look at buckwheat, wheat, barley, oats, and then all the supporting crops, clover, peas, sorghum. It hit me. I said, oh man, clover, peas, sorghum? Wait a second. I love sorghum. But it's part of the rotation of growing good corn. I see all of that in New Orleans. You know, you see it. It's still currently on the table. Buckwheat crepes is the national dish of New Orleans outside of its corn and rice culture and legume culture, red beans and rice. Well, that's an international food way, and John's documented that to a farthing well. And you cannot grow corn without beans. You can't grow corn without squash. You can't grow corn without sorghum. And as I learned that, I went, oh, my God, I can't just make grits. I got to find a market and grow all these other crops to keep the land healthy and make the corn taste good. That's how I got into barley, oats, and all the rest of it. And when I looked in our region, I found out that all the recipes inside our local cuisine, which is called the Carolina Rice Kitchen, it's not a place. It's actually a set of foods that are all interlinked to market, kitchen gardening, elite foods in those kitchen gardening scenarios, and the maroon foods are the hidden gardens of slaves. When you put all that together, it makes this very elegant cuisine, which is not nearly as robust, I think, still, as the cuisines that surround Cajun country coming down to New Orleans. I mean, it's not there. I mean, our use of chili is kind of like chili wimps. You know, we put a little bit on. You know, when I go to New Orleans, I want chili to speak to me. Even chilies have meaning in those growing systems for corn. And then I found out you had to do all that with rice. And I look back at New Orleans again, and you start with red beans and rice, which is the Bible food, and you walk away from that and say, what else were they growing? And you start to see all these crops coming into rotations to keep the land healthy, and it actually makes the food taste better. And then when I listen to how John deconstructs this all the way to Native American systems, because after all, corn belongs to Native America. We didn't invent that. It was here before we got here. When John takes this back to mound culture, when I hear a chef talking about mound culture, I know I've come to the right place. Right? Because only the real cuisines in America that survive, those iconic and totemic cuisines of their region, show Native American cookery first, up front. It comes all the way through. And I listen to John deconstruct the history of Calais all the way back to mound culture, and I'm going, man, where have I been? Why didn't I read more?
You've just been doing the other half of it. I've been taking everything you're doing and throwing it in a pot. And you've been working on your side, and I was working on this side. So I was salivating as you were talking there about all of these unique flavors, ingredients, cultural tie-ins, seasonal tie-ins. It really makes, I think, the listener come to understand the challenge of the farm, the challenge of the farmer every single day trying to figure out what's next in that rotation to guarantee success from crop to crop. And yet, with all the unknowns out there, it's got to be just mind-boggling to bring the goods to the table. How did you get to a point now where you have other farmers or you're growing it yourself? What's the process that brings you to where you are today? Who's involved in producing the goods that have the Anson Mills label?
That's a terrific question, John. Because I was in the hotel business, and we were obviously in the hotel business, you have to be keenly aware of the business model and generating profit and do all your site analysis and the classic marketing things you have to do up front before you even start planning a property like that. And I tended to be involved from the inception when somebody got the idea, hey, that whole building, maybe that would make an inn, or maybe that would make a hotel, and we want to have a restaurant in there. I had done that for almost 3 decades when I decided to walk away and just start farming corn and rice. And my mission from the beginning was to try to turn some of that marketing model upside down. I said, what if I just narrow the audience to chefs? Because every chef is worth between 5 and 50,000 people. And if they're like John Fowles, they're worth hundreds of thousands of maybe millions of people. What if I just market to chefs? What if I just say farmers first? What if I take that as a main mission? Farmers first, and we're driven by chefs. So our first thing was farmers first, and then the second mission was by chefs for chefs, period. I started just repeating that to myself. I said, okay, if I'm a farmer, what do I need to have? The first thing that pops up, it's like a no-brainer, is you need seed. I learned this immediately because I got seed from bootleggers for these old corns that we started to grow, which was loads of fun finding. I mean, I'm from California. Can you imagine me driving around the country in Appalachia and out in South Carolina in these small towns, sitting at the gas station waiting for a bootlegger to show up? Yeah. That took about a year to even pull off. But once I got accepted and got off the grid, I started finding these old corns, and I had one family who particularly was helpful, and they were growing everything they made. Food preservation top to bottom, Southern Pantry. They're over towards the coast in northern South Carolina near the North Carolina border. Just a wonderful family. They were in the local church register since the late 1600s, farming the same land since then, and everything had been carried forward to the modern generation. And unfortunately, what happened is that bifurcation of cultural interests, the kids really didn't want to carry on. The patron of the family and the matron of the family decided that they were going to teach me how to farm and mill. So my first job was to go in and cut stuff in the kitchen, take garbage out. I said, this is farming. I said, you got to cook this first. You got to understand it at the table first before you go out to the field. So for 3 months, I was essentially assistant to this bootlegger's wife, cooking biscuits and God knows what. They were doing their own Graham wheat and making Graham biscuits. They were preserving. Oh, wow. He was aging up moonshine. His moonshine was so good. He had 10-year and 20-year, and he had fresh stuff too. And they made their own wine. And all this was actually a pharmacopoeia and a cultural food system. Mm-hmm. And I'm looking at that going, God bless, this is so wonderful. It's like the full table right here in front of you. And it took me literally 30 days to get what they were telling me. Because all I wanted to do was, he had these beautiful old mills out in the country, you know, down a tractor path, go through the woods, cross another tractor path, down another tractor path, and you get to a shed. And inside there, there'd be an old tractor chassis driving these old mills, and he had old thumper sifters. You could hear them when you got near the shed. That thumper, 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 thumper. And I'm going, this is just terrific. And his mills were perfect. They were milling super cold, super quiet. Got to be quiet if you're in the bootlegging business. And so I had a beautiful introduction to this. His fields for eating food, and that's what they called it. This is kitchen food. This isn't, because I kept saying, why are you growing all those different things together out there? And he said, this is the way we've always done it. The 4x4 check, you got kirker bits on the ground, squash, you got beans coming up the corn, you got corn in the summer, and all those crops have a meaning, and at the table, they also have a market. And the whole idea there is to keep the land healthy, And you know what? If you got really good cowpeas, you can cover up a lot of bootlegger corn after you pick it, because they'll climb right over it, and then nobody will be able to fly over and see what you're doing.
Okay, y'all, we're going to take a quick little break, and we're going to come back and continue to chat a little bit about this wonderful topic.
Yeah, I hope there are a couple more bootlegger stories.
Look, we got to hear about the bootleggers. We have to hear about the bootleggers' corn, those classic. I got to hear the story again. Y'all, we're going to be back in just a second. Don't you dare go anywhere. We're pouring moonshine.
Oh, give me some harmony grits, some good old sugar-cured ham. Give me a great big bowl of gravy, I'd be such a happy man if I could see magnolias and azaleas in bloom. Let me up to the table there, boys. Scoot way over there. And give me lots of elbow room. Then pass me them man fried hoe cakes. Some good old black-eyed peas. Give me a hay rack.
I want to see you at high noon. Noontime, Thursdays on KRVS 88.7. For rock, roll, rhythm, it's Old Gold on KRVS. An hour on Thursdays at noontime. Hi, this is Lee Kleinpeter with an invite to join me Thursdays at noon on KRVS 88.7 for Fats Domino, Chuck Berry, Elvis, Carl Perkins, even Dolly Parton.
Did you know that during the past 100 years, many Africans have begun to practice Judaism? Hello, I'm Georges Collinet. Join me for the songs and stories of Jewish communities in sub-Saharan Africa next time on Afropop Worldwide from PRI, Public Radio International.
Sunday night at 8 on KRVS.
Hi, this is Bill Bowens from The Dirty Rice Show, inviting you to join either Mr. Lee Kleinpeter or myself every Saturday night from 8:30 p.m. until 10 p.m. for Dirty Rice right here on KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles, Public Radio for Acadiana.
I'd lie on my baby, stay with my woman till I die. With a toothpick in my hand, I'd dig a 10-foot ditch and run out through the jungle fighting lions with the switch. Because you know I love you, baby. And Mona Lisa was a man.
Ritz ain't groceries.
I don't know. I really don't know, David, where you get our music from, but it's always absolutely perfect. I'm still waiting for the Starting It Up album to come out on food. Give me some elbow room and pass me that hominy grit. Anyway, y'all, welcome back to Stirring It Up, the best tasting show on radio, and certainly the one with the best music, no doubt about that. And we're so lucky today to have a good, close, personal friend, Glenn Roberts, of course, proprietor of Anson Mills in Charleston, South Carolina, where he grows, harvests, processes, and, of course, distributes some of the most unusual grains to the restaurant business. We also want everybody to go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/stirringitupradio, and let us know what you think about, what you want to know more about, or what you want us to shut up about. Anyway, we were talking about the bootleggers. I remember you brought all the corn to the podium in Napa Valley when we were doing our symposium over there, and you showed this long ear of corn, and you were talking about bootleggers' corn. Tell us a little bit about that.
The bootleggers that I've met are really, really concerned, and the ones that I work with are the very small people who are just doing their local community. They're not in the NASCAR business riding it over the Appalachian Ridge getting chased, like what we call Groundhogsville people, which those are huge manufacturing type things. So I'm talking about families that kind of in it because they always have been in it. They're probably supplying the local sheriff and the mayor. and everybody else, man or woman, sheriff or mayor too, by the way. Doesn't mm-hmm. make any difference. Everybody loves sipping. This is a dying art, and as we see the micro distilling revolution come, hopefully it'll save this part that we love. And the what attracted me, although I've been accused of drinking whiskey every once in a while, what attracted me most was how diverse their corn growing was, how many different kinds of corn. You go down the road and you're 10 miles away, they got a totally different kind of corn. Oh, yeah, that one's been in our family the whole time. Sometimes you go 30 miles and the same corn pops up, but it really has a different flavor, even though it's exactly the same corn for milling in the fields. And all of those corns, obviously, were meant to become mash for whiskey.
Right, right.
By the same token, they had phenomenal flavors. And when I was doing just commercial corn, even if it was organic, it didn't have those same kind of robust, really dominant highs where you had citrus and violets and all kinds of things. It was almost like wine. And you get down into a punch of deep roast corn and cream corn right above it. And in the end, you're just loaded with minerals. And everybody sit around and say, well, that's beverage language. Yeah, it's beverage language because, you know, Strom Thurmond said, all Southerners love corn, especially that which you can drink. And these are families who for generations have seen corn as a liquid, even when it was dry in the field and making grits and meal. It is a liquid, and they're thinking beverage the whole time as they're selecting. And they're called single-family hand-select corns. And they have personal identity. And the rule that I sort of heard over and over again, knocking around Appalachian, down in small towns and outside of small towns, North Carolina, Virginia, South Carolina, Georgia, was if your family has a bootlegger corn for 3 or 4 years, it's no longer Tom Harden's corn down the road. It's now Joe Wilson's corn right here in your family, because it only takes that long for the corn to start drifting because it's farmer selected. And it's a wonderful thing to find out. The second thing behind it is that all those people were really interested in what came before the corn. The idea of rotation, what do you grow before the corn to make the corn taste better and make it drink better? And diversity would be, you'd see sesame, sorghum, peas and everything growing together in some of these fields just before they planted corn. It'd all be out there and it'd be kind of short. And as soon as the buckwheat in that mix and the sesame got to flower stage, they'd cut it in. And they're hard on the coast, so they can, you know, down in South Georgia, their first plant date, Valentine's Day.
Wow.
So you could have a full crop of Benny in a cornfield up, cut it down and go to corn and make corn before the freeze date on the same field.
Wow.
And I saw all that happening in all these different places, and I was just astounded. I said, you mean I need to do all this just to get some milk corn? And the resounding family statement was, yes, this is the way it works. If you're off the grid, if you go down and buy a bunch of fertilizer at the local, you know, feed house, feed and seed, you know, that's going to alert a lot of people. You don't get to do that in a bootleg trade.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So you've got to have good land, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that was where I first started thinking about Benny. And I grew Benny for years just because I was told to. I had no idea that I could eat it green and it cooks like okra and it's wonderful with rice. I had no idea that the leaves were like really good in salads and really good in stews as a young plant. And I had no idea that you could make anything. I didn't even know what Benny cake was, which is sesame flour. And had I done my John Foles homework, I would have known all this stuff. But it's just a litany of being behind the power curve and having the farmer and being head of understanding what's supposed to happen at the table. Because Benny cake flour is phenomenal. And everybody likes sesame oil.
Right.
But you wouldn't think that it is, given the fact that we have a sesame called K10, which is bred only for oil. And frankly, in its flower state, is not very memorable. It's the old sesames, or bennies, that actually are low oil that make the best Benny cake flour. They also make terrific oil. That legacy of oil, something else I learned from John Foltz, involves olive trees. And here we go. What do you need olive trees for to grow rice? And when I looked at our historic farm journals, I see people doing olive trees, pressing the oil, taking that compost from the press, all those pits and the pulp, and they put it into the new crop rice feed beds when they were growing rice seed, the most important rice farming. And that was considered to be the best compost to grow rice.
We have a couple of more minutes here before we run. From corn to rice, I know that you've moved in, of course, into all of the other grains that you've been talking about. What are you finding particularly successful and exciting in the marketplace today coming from Anson Mills?
I think that it is the fringe crop table foods that are actually now coming to the fore. Our first rice farmers in our region were from directly from the Veneto in Italy. So you see them bringing over emmer and einkorn, and that's Faro Piccolo in Italy today, einkorn is, and emmer is Faro Medio. So we see a huge resurgence in interest in these ancient grains and their function in agriculture at the table. Obviously, they're phenomenal to eat, but their function in agriculture in our region for rice culture is you run them as winter crops and you can graze them off because they grow like weeds. They're so persistent.
Wow.
That if you've got water, they're water tolerant. You've got salt, they're salt tolerant. And that's true for the barleys and the ryes and everything else that were indigenous to our culture. So you see massive distillation and great big cattle husbandry, and you see that reflected again earlier. So everything that happened good in Charleston was happening a century earlier in New Orleans, and you have good records in New Orleans. So if I find something that John Foltz has researched down there, I have to go plowing through our stuff to see if it actually was reflected again in our system. So the most important thing would be the fringe elements of the Roman rise that were indigenous to our culture that made the first great Alambic rise that we had, and George Washington's Mount Vernon just released one of their aged ryes that they put together in the same tradition. So we see all those things that are tangential to distillation, tangential to the cattle industry, and all those in our region around Charleston coming back as modern foods now, which no one was actually even thinking about them 2 decades ago.
So why do you think there is that renewed focus on heirloom grains? Are we talking about flavor? Are we talking about nutrition? What do you think's kind of brought all that together to create that renewed focus?
That's a terrific statement. The most important cultural aspect has come from chefs who are also scholars. And it's going to sound silly in a way, but it's really true. The models for this rest in people with these massive, enriched lives like John, where they're equally a scholar and a chef. That used to be almost unheard of. That was like 5-10 people in America. All these younger guys are looking at John going, oh, well, I got to understand how the plants work. I've got to understand how food history works. Mm-hmm. I have to put that together, and I have to make it sensitive to kind of cuisine that I want to develop. And you'll see chefs talking to people then about the farming systems because they're trying to be local and trying to keep their land and their immediate region healthy. And if you go to John's work, you'll find all the stories there that accelerate this. Everybody going this direction. Great.
Glenn,
but there's only a few pioneers.
Glenn, we've so enjoyed talking with you today. We could talk with you for hours and hours and hours. So we're just going to have to stop here and plan you for another show.
Glenn, we have about 500 students at Nicholls State University and the John Foltz Culinary Institute now, 35 states, 9 countries on campus. I desperately need to have you as a guest speaker as we get to the 7 nations that we teach at the Institute, from our Native American cultures all the way to the last of our Creole countries, the Italians coming over, and now, of course, the Asians. I would love to have you come spend a day with us, but you are so fascinating. I mean, the knowledge that you have, I think our culinary students would just go wild to hear your talk. So we're going to invite you, and hopefully you'll accept and come on in and be a part of the Institute. We'd love to have you.
John, you're a shining light for what we all need to do right for the future of food. And I can't tell you how honored I am to be able to spend this time with you and Michelle, and I would be delighted to be there. You tell me where and I'll show up.
And Louisiana students at Nicholls State will be much better off for having met you. I can guarantee you that. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much, too. And you too, Michelle. Have a great time.
Shirley, you're going to have all of his info on our website.
Yes,
right?
Absolutely. All about Anson Mills. As a cook, you can also order so many of the different kinds of things as well. So we'll have it all there. So you can learn more about him and the kind of work that he's doing, as well as order some pretty fabulous process.
And I know that one of the challenges of introducing a new ingredient to the general public, of course, is the fear factor that cooks have if they don't really know. And Michelle, you and I have talked about it regarding grains, of course, and yet cooking most grains is just something similar to cooking grits or similar to cooking rice or anything else. You put the dry grain in a pan of water, you bring it to a boil, you simmer it, you add flavors to it, and I mean, what's going to keep it from cooking? Michelle, you're making that special fountain of youth food that you're cooking over there.
Makes a delicious little breakfast food, and it's healthy. It's good for you. And well, then, of course, you know, I've been experimenting, too, with just using, and I know this isn't a grain, but the lentils and a little bit on chickpeas. And I tend to find, you know, for really extra flavor, I've been looking at curries and experimenting a little bit with curry, the quinoa that we had talked about, and even putting a little. I have a great recipe for the for mangoes with lentils and a little curry, which sounds kind of odd, but absolutely delicious.
Oh, I think that sounds perfect. I know, like in a lot of Turkish dishes, lentils are such a major part, you know, cooked and then processed and made into soups. And oh, gosh, there are so many fabulous things. And, of course, I grew up in the Midwest. Oats were a big part of our cooking, as well as barleys. And so our soups always had barleys in them. And so that one isn't as much of a surprise to me as you know, some of the other grains. That I think the biggest thing, though, is, like, John, you know, I can always tell the students you cook by taste, and you cook by doneness, not by time. And so that's one of the things, just like when you cook your rice, you know when it's ready, and you're going to have to just experiment with other grains.
Well, you know, talking about grains, I have a great recipe, a real quick one. It's using corn. It's a good cheese garlic grits souffle. This is making grits. I love to do grits in different ways. And, of course, you can use the wonderful stone ground yellow grits or the stone ground white grits. Either one is good, or you can mix them. You can get them both. Anyway, y'all, you're going to start with about a cup and a half of just a shredded sharp cheddar cheese, because it's going to be the base of that grits dish. It's also going to be a second cheese in it. It's going to be a half a cup of freshly grated Parmesan. So you're going to have the Parmesan and the cheddar cheese together, about 2 cups. You're going to have 1 cup of your stone ground grits, or a half a cup of white and a half a cup of yellow, which will kind of make it very interesting in look. And then, of course, what you're going to do is you're going to bring in one of these nice thick bottom pots. You're going to bring a 2 cups of water and 2 cups of milk to a rolling boil. You can add a little half a teaspoon of salt into it, and then, of course, 2 tablespoons of unsalted butter. So now you have your milk and your water and your butter. So you see, things are starting to look pretty good already, right?
Yeah, it is.
Are you with me? And then you're going to add a half a teaspoon of just white pepper. You can add black pepper. You can even add little slivers of like a jalapeno or a cayenne pepper for color in there. I always love to crush 2 or 3 cloves of garlic down into that milk and water as well. So the 2 cups of water, 2 cups of milk, along with the salt and the butter and the white pepper and the cloves of garlic, will all be simmering wonderfully right there. And then I'm going to add to that my cup of stone ground grits. And I'm going to let it just simmer. And, of course, you know the rest of the story. You're going to let it cook while stirring gently. You can add about a dash of Worcestershire sauce in there if you want, even a dash of hot sauce if you want into it. You're going to cook that around and make sure that it's totally cooked. The grains, you want a little al dente, but naturally it's going to pick up all of that wonderful flavor. Then, once it's cooked, you're going to add the cheese, the cheddar cheese and the Parmesan to it. You're going to melt it beautifully into that. Bring it out of the pot into a bowl and allow it to cool slightly. And once it's cool enough to add 4 eggs that are whipped gently, you're going to fold it in very quickly so the eggs don't scramble, so you let the grits cool enough, and then you're going to pour that into a buttered dish, and you're going to bake it in that oven that's at about 350 to 75 degrees until lightly browned on the top, and the eggs are going to souffle the grits with the cheese. It's going to be absolutely wonderful. You can even put that in a pan, cut it in squares, let it chill, cut it in squares, and then pan saute it in the morning with 2 poached eggs on top of it.
Sounds delicious.
You talk about good. Our Creole, that cheese garlic grit souffle Creole style, will be available on the website. Y'all, thank you so much for joining us. Go out and find some grain and eat it. It's good for you. And you may find a new experience in your life, like Michelle did with those little grain brownies. She's going to give me the formula for it at some point in time. Y'all, we're going to see you next week.
Flaxseed.
Flaxseed. She's found it out. We'll see you next time. Hey, hail to the flaxseed.
everyone. This is Pat Mitchell-Worley. Join us next time on Bill Street Caravan as we travel to Jazz Fest in New Orleans to hear a tribute concert to Memphis icon Alex Chilton. That plus our feature host Adam Hill will continue his series Made in Memphis. That's all coming up next time on Bill Street Caravan.
Saturday night at 11 here on KRVS.
Edition of Harpistry, Sunday at midnight and Monday at noon, right here on KRVS.
Is an encore presentation of Rendezvous des Cajuns.
Bonsoir, bonjour, mes amis. Welcome to the Rendezvous des Cajuns radio and TV program in Unions, Louisiana. No, I'm not Claudia, and I'm not Vincent. Moi, ici, c'est Erline Broussard, and I'll be your host tonight. This program, the only one of its kind, is sponsored by the City of Eunice, the Jean Lafitte National Historic